This is Military Mondays with Major David Katz.
Time is 8:18. A very good morning, David Katz. And we always do that, like we throw you right into it, and then it takes us a while to actually get to the subject that we want to speak about.
We've got to warm up first,
though. Yeah, it is. It is. It's like a stretch before a run.
I thought you were going to go there. I mean, I love the way you're handling your midlife crisis. I think it's phenomenal.
I know, I'm already like 7 or 8 years past my midlife crisis.
Well, you're handling it very well.
Thank you very, very much.
Fantastic.
Yes.
Have you've obviously discussed the run, so we're not going to go over that again. But if you haven't, I'd love to hear about it. I mean, it looked great. I just watched you going over the finish line.
Did you see me going over the finish line?
It was magnificent.
Wasn't that inspiring?
It was magnificent.
Didn't you want to get out there and just run?
I did. No, I started cheering in my house. People wanted to know what was going on. Next door neighbors were phoning to know why I was screaming.
Like, but that was me finishing. It was, I was very, very emotional at that point. Not really. Either way, we are talking about war crimes. And the reason I wanted to have this conversation with you is I find that, you know, as we become more vocal on social media and as we feel less heard, we become more and more dramatic. So anyone who disagrees with you on the right is a Nazi. Anybody who disagrees with you on the left is a communist. Somebody, you know, somebody does something in a war situation that you don't like, they're a war criminal. So we live in this world of hyperbolic statement in order to evoke a response, to become heard. I'm not really sure. It's a whole combination of all of these things. So I wanted to take just one of the concepts, which is the concept of a war crime, and understand what it is, how it's defined, what the process is to determine it, etc.
Well, I think it's pretty clear what constitutes a war crime in terms of the various conventions that were convened, and in terms of the Nuremberg trials.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's much argument. There's not much room. What's more interesting is whether it's been evenly applied across the board, and quite obviously it hasn't been applied across the board. So we can discuss what constitutes a war crime. I think it's reasonably interesting.
Well, let's start off there, because what is it?
Okay, well, first of all, it talks to the individual culpability of a soldier or somebody on the battlefield for contravening the rules of war. There are actually laws of war that have to be followed.
Right.
Which sounds a bit improbable, but it's true. And these laws have been set up by the various Hague Conventions, the Geneva Convention, the Geneva Protocols.
And that'll include things like ruling out the use of chemical or neurological or biological warfare.
Bacterial warfare, willful killing, torture, or inhuman treatment of prisoners of war.
Right.
Using dum-dum bullets on the battlefield. I mean, it doesn't make sense if you think about it.
No, of course not.
I mean, the horrors of war, and people are worried about whether you use dum-dum rounds. Are people using a depleted uranium rounds these days? But anyway, that's written into the conventions. So there's certain ways that you have to treat hostages, POWs, civilians, and these are governed by these various protocols. So it's pretty clear once you go out there. There's also the concept, which is very, very interesting, of following an unlawful order, because it's not good enough these days to turn around and say that you were following orders from the top. This was confirmed at the Nuremberg trials,
which because of course that was a major defense.
So you have a duty as a soldier to not follow an unlawful order. What constitutes an unlawful order is very, very interesting. I mean, in the heat of battle, can you imagine trying to determine whether somebody's order is lawful or not? So you can get into trouble both ways, I suppose. So let's say that the laws of war are reasonably easy to find and understandable. It's the application that I have a problem with, in that you see various nations doing the same type of thing. One will be punished for it, the other won't. Let's take the deployment of Agent Orange in Vietnam, for instance, which has caused massive defoliation of the jungles in Vietnam, and also caused a lot of deformity in the kids for decades afterwards. Nobody's been held responsible from the USA side. And I would say it clearly constitutes a war crime.
And Sand is asking about Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But I mean, surely we've
discussed that. That is very interesting.
Because surely that was prior to Nuremberg anyway.
It wasn't prior to the Geneva Convention. Right. So there's a point there.
Yes.
There's a point is whether you can knowingly take that many civilian lives. I suppose the test is whether you specifically targeting civilian lives. And one could argue that by dropping an atom bomb, which is going to kill everybody and anybody and anything, is whether you should be held responsible for the civilian lives.
Mm.
But there was strategic bombing. People forget about the Dresden strategic bombing raids without nuclear weapons, where 30,000 people perished in one night's fire bombing in Dresden. And whether the Allies should have been held responsible for war crimes based on strategic bombing and nuclear bombing. Interesting question. I suppose that's less clear.
Mm.
I mean, you could argue that that it was a strategic military decision to drop the nuclear bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in order to shorten the war and save American lives. And there's a good argument for that also.
Right, absolutely.
Judging by the way the Japanese defended themselves towards the end, they were fanatic. And the only way to end it was probably the bombing of ended early was the bombing of Nagasaki. So, not an easy question, a good question, but not an easy one to answer.
All right, so we've got this more or less a sense of what a war crime is. Now people are at war, and you're saying that a soldier can't defend his actions by saying he was following orders. What does he do given a situation in the field? Now, obviously you know this more than I do, but an army can't function successfully unless there's absolute faith and trust in the flow of command.
Absolutely,
you certainly can't have every kid out there deciding whether something is appropriate or not appropriate.
No, absolutely.
I mean, it would come to a complete standstill.
It would come to a standstill, but there's still a duty. There's an onus on somebody receiving the order.
Right.
To judge whether that order is unlawful or not. It's a difficult.
It's interesting because we had a very strange case last week that we spoke about, where an American, I think it was a pilot or whatever it was given this order to destroy a porta potty.
Yeah.
In I think it was in Iraq. It was an ISIS porta potty or something like that.
Yes.
And they said no. And they wouldn't do it because they said they cannot see how this porta potty would be a threat to American life, and they didn't do it.
And the porta potty was
occupied,
or
well, I think it was unoccupied at the time.
Yeah.
So there you did have a very very clear modern day example of somebody saying, you know what, this doesn't make sense to me. I'm not carrying out this order.
Well, there's been on the drone strikes also, one of the operators, I watched an interesting program a couple of months back on one of the operators who came clean on what he was doing, who also at the end of the day refused to operate his drone and deploy the weapons of the drone.
Right.
Eventually he had enough. He had done it on a few occasions. He had enough and he didn't do it. Whether that was an unlawful command or not is open to debate. But I suppose it gets down to personal conscience. And you have to be of very high moral value. You have to have high moral values and be incredibly strong, I suppose, to refuse to do an order. I suppose it's all about what you think is morally correct or not.
Yes, because you know that you're going to land up sanctioned severely, probably by your own military.
Yes, absolutely. Right. I don't know if too many of these people have been treated as heroes. They have been sanctioned, I suppose, most of them. And honestly, they set the bar as to what's lawful and what's unlawful and how to react to it. So I admire people that can actually turn around. As you say, in times of war, you need discipline, but it's a two-way street. You have to trust the people that are giving you orders, and they have to trust you that you're going to perform your duty. So it's a two-way trust. And once that bond of trust is broken, either way, that's where you're going to have problems. So if you can't trust your commanding officer to act within the law, with his commands, you've got a problem, and you must probably got a duty and an onus to disobey those commands, because you're not going to afterwards, when you're held to account, you cannot come up with the excuse that you were merely following orders or in fear of your life, and that's why you follow those orders. So you have to, if you don't want to be held responsible afterwards, you have to make that brave move. Not an easy ask.
I'm chatting to Major David Katz, and we're speaking about the concept of war crimes. The reason I chose the subject, as I said earlier, was because we throw around a lot of these phrases. Everybody on the right of you is a Nazi, everyone on the left of you is a communist. People are racists and bigots, and they're guilty of war crimes. And I'd like to just try and spend some time understanding the words that we have become so comfortable using. If you've got any comments or any thoughts, 34519 or 061-895-1019. Neil says wars are so unnecessary. Can't people learn to disagree agreeably? Wars should not be a game that people play that destroys human life. Where's the fear of God? Well, unfortunately, sadly, Neil, it's very often the fear of God that causes people from various religions to go to war. And certainly our history, the history of the whole world is littered with religious, the bodies produced by religious wars. So unfortunately, perhaps should be a deterrent, but generally isn't. We're going to go to news headlines, some ads, we're going to take some music, and then we'll come back and chat to Major David Katz. I want to know from him how the system works once somebody or once a group. This is your Morning Mayhem on 101.9 Chai FM. I'm chatting to Major David Katz, and we are speaking about the concept of war crimes. What is it? Unsigned says, Howard, and that's in capital letters, stop dancing around the real issue. War crimes are horrendous. Israel is guilt-ridden. All right, we hadn't even mentioned the subject of Israel because, first of all, I want to understand what a war crime is, and certainly, before we would even get to Israel, there's a multitude of countries, certainly mostly in the Middle East, that are horrific in their use of banned substances. Certainly, Syria gassing their own people. Mm. But interesting that Unsigned goes immediately to talk about Israel. The bias is evident. It's very, very clear. But that aside, let's talk about Israel. Let's talk about the fact that Israel has the notion of war crimes leveled against Israel over and over again, even though you've got many of these counter discussions and counter reports saying that the IDF certainly is a moral army. Doesn't mean, of course, that things can't go wrong, and it doesn't mean that individuals within the organization can't behave poorly in a time of conflict.
Well, I suppose a test, Howard, if we have to apply the test evenly across the board, I would say that it would be military actions that go beyond military necessity. I think that's a
military reasonable. Actions.
Military actions that go beyond the immediate military necessity.
All right, cool.
So in other words, militaries use maximum force. We're not a police outfit that is supposed to use minimum force to get to its objective.
Right.
So we have a mandate to use maximum force in order to achieve our objective. Mm. But I suppose it has to be
with accountability.
With accountability, right. and in the realms of military necessity. So if we shouldn't do more than is militarily necessary to achieve our objective.
Okay.
Now, I don't know if that's vague or not, but I mean,
it might not be vague in terms of definition, but it is certainly vague in terms of application, because you could argue various, the cases are clear. When Assad uses chemical warfare against his people, that is clear. When Iran is using its military to arrest and kill people and impose martial law on the streets when a woman uncovers her face, that is an abuse of power.
So some examples are pretty clear.
Those are clear.
Let's look at Srebrenica.
Right.
Where 6,000 or 7,000 or 8,000 Muslims were put to death by the Bosnian Serbs. That was there a military necessity behind that? Obviously not. I mean, it's a clear cut decision we can turn around. Mm. But let's say there's collateral damage, on the front line, and there happens to be civilian deaths and collateral damage. Not so clear cut. When you examine that. So if we're looking at the IDF specifically, I mean, I would take it on a case by case, example, and have a look to see whether they acted within the realms of military necessity in order to achieve their objective. So let's get a couple of examples of where they didn't, where they exceeded that. Mm. And I'm sure they are. I mean, where militaries operate, it's also how the military afterwards will deal with those people who have been excessive. But I can't think, I mean, just off the top of my head, I can't think of a more recent example of where the IDF has exceeded military necessity to protect its borders.
I mean, the first example that is going to be leveled, certainly at me or at, you know, that I would expect is the Gaza border riot, where the press and where there was a great deal of effort put in to try and show that this was a peaceful process, whereas of course we know certainly after the fact and even during those that were prepared to see it could see that it wasn't a peaceful protest, and it was thousands of people that were about to breach a border with the intention of crossing into Israel and killing civilians. Yes. So we know that was said by Hamas, that was the instruction given to people. So what could Israel have done something different? I would love to have thought that they can to avoid the loss of life. Any loss of life is horrific. And the fact is that people need to own responsibility going to the border and taking children to that border and becoming part of it. Yes, they need to take ownership of that. But at the same time, it's a Hamas ruled area. They are being indoctrinated and pushed and I think abused in many ways by Hamas. So we have to be a little bit more perhaps understanding of that, or I do. Everybody can choose their own direction here. Either way, was there another way that Israel could have dealt with it? I don't know. Certainly, those who support Hamas have come out very strongly and accused Israel of war crimes, but there's been no further follow-up through any international criminal court, etc.
Look, I think the Israelis also took defensive measures. The measures that they took were not purely offensive. I mean, they've spent billions of dollars on this Iron Dome, which is a purely defensive mechanism to take on these rockets that are crashing into Israel. Mm. Sometimes there's hundreds of rockets attack on a particular day. So there's two different options they could take. They could take defensive measures. And they can take offensive measures. And I mean, a good military is going to deploy defensive and offensive measures in order to counterattack this. And I mean, there are people on the other side within the Gaza borders firing these rockets. Now, how do you deal with that? How do you deal with that? Do you wait for the rockets to come over and you defensively attack them? Or do you go through and try and take out the source of where they're coming from? So I suppose they deployed two different methods and there's collateral damage involved. Not making excuses, but did they go beyond military necessity in order to nullify the effect of rockets coming over into civilian areas? Mm.
Do you think there's an army in the world that hasn't had an issue where soldiers have acted outside the bounds of acceptability? There can't be. It's not possible.
It brutalizes you. War brutalizes, and the longer it goes on, so people become more and more brutal.
Right.
And there's not an army in the world that you can turn around and say is perfect and doesn't act outside the bounds of what it's supposed to be doing. That's just nonsense. I can't believe that. That doesn't exist. Mm. So every single military in the world,
and it's, as you say, it's how they
subject to excesses,
and it's how they self-correct. Really, that's the most important factor here: is how the army itself views those type of incidents. Are those people taken to task? Are they being censured? Are they being dealt with? And therefore correcting the whole ethos of a particular army.